I think an underlying theme in what I want to talk about today is the importance of, I can't think of the right word, unification or reunification, reconnecting at every level, from the personal through policy to the political, if ideas and practices of user involvement and public participation are to be meaningful, have an impact, and to make serious inroads into the nature of the worlds we inhabit. And let me explain briefly why I've come to this conclusion, and then take you through what I see as some of the key stages in the development of public participation in modern times, and also some of the key problems that I believe have encouraged the impetus for such involvement, as well as some of the key concerns it must engage with if it's to challenge these problems. Also, if I have time, I'd like to try and signal how problematic participation tends itself to embody those same problems that it's there to do something about, rather than displace them. That's to say, the irony that some participation actually reflects, rather than challenges, the exclusions and barriers that we may imagine it offers a remedy to. Participation, thus, is not necessarily on our side, depending, of course, on who we are. So let me briefly describe what's led me to this viewpoint. And this is another anniversary. We've heard about the anniversary of Aardvark. It's also my 40th anniversary, the anniversary of work that I've been doing for 40 years with Susie Croft, my colleague and partner, engaged in issues of participation. I have done this in different policy areas, in different areas of participatory activity, where pressures for participation have been underpinned by different ideological motivations. We've done it from different perspectives as worker and activist, educator and practitioner, researcher and commentator. I've done it also from different settings, from community groups and organisations, from user-led organisations, from large policy and charitable organisations, from research and educational organisations. So in one sense, this of course is a very personal critique, but it's one that has engaged with and drawn on the work of very many others, locally, nationally and internationally, as researchers, activists, policymakers, educators and practitioners, but mostly particularly as service users and other engaged citizens or non-citizens. By way of introduction, let me say that I believe we seem to be at a significant stage in the development of such citizen participation. And this is, I think, is really our opportunity. But I think I ought to try and sketch out what I would identify personally as four key phases in modern interest in and pressure towards greater public participation, getting us to this point. And I see these as international in their scope. Obviously, I can only headline them here, but I can refer you to more detailed discussion of them. Also, I think that such historical perspective can offer us much more in making sense of and taking forward participation than more conventional reliance on models and typologies. So, phase one I would describe as working, and forgive me if it seems like I'm making a bit of a departure here, working for universal suffrage and social rights. The first half of the 20th century was a particular time of increasing democratisation of representative political structures and the extension of suffrage in the UK and beyond. But this time of increasing international political, economic and social conflict, uncertainty and inequality, with rising pressure for electoral representation, also came to be coupled internationally with pressure for the achievement of social rights. Such rights are taken to include the right to work, to decent housing, education, adequate income and social security and proper health and medical services. And the achievement of those rights was associated with the creation of post-World War II welfare states, not just ours. I think phase two can be, and I think Fiona touched on it in her early work, can be summed up as the development of provisions for participatory democracy and community development, and is associated with the 1960s onwards, and I think can be seen as a reaction to the paternalism and top-down nature of post-war welfare states, which were at least non-participatory, if not actively anti-participatory. Legislative requirements for participation, for example in land planning and schemes for community development like hers that she talked about, emerged to counter the continuing problems of poverty, exclusion and inequality that had not been resolved by the expansion of state welfare. I'm happy to make this available if people don't need to make notes. I'd headline phase three as provisions for participation in health and social care, although they can be seen rightly as broader than this, developing particularly perhaps in the 1980s. This is the phase of development that generally seems to be seen as the starting point for considerations of user, patient and public involvement. And it's coupled, I think, with two major developments: the emergence of what we call user movements committed to challenging the exclusion and marginalisation that they saw themselves, ourselves as experiencing, and broader shifts to the right in political ideology associated with neoliberalism and the new right, committed to consumerism and the market and the diminution of state intervention and involvement, touching on what you raised in your question. Finally, where we are today, phase four, which I would personally describe as kind of reaction and renewal, where the tensions, I think, between competing ideological underpinnings and objectives for user and public involvement have become more manifest, with the service system as much subverting service users' aspirations for say, empowerment and involvement as supporting them, coupling rhetoric about engagement with welfare reform policies of impoverishment and exclusion and cruelty, and service users and their organisations increasingly recognising this contradiction, appreciating the continuing discriminations, inequalities and exclusions they face, and beginning to articulate more independently their, our, own ideas, agendas and campaigns for say and involvement. If anything we should give us pause for thought about participation, it's being where we are today, I think, in its history. If anything should highlight its ambiguity and potentially regressive implications, it's the way statutory initiatives can now be seen to be co-opting key concerns of service users, like self-management, peer support, recovery and personalisation, putting them to reactionary purposes. And that brings me to the second part of my discussion. There are identifying criteria by which to judge all this. For all the talk about PPI, user involvement, participation, public participation, and the ways in which they've crept into the political and policy lexicon, I want to highlight a series of continuing obstacles in the way of them being meaningful and effective, which can make up the context for their operation and potential. These are all issues that connect with the problems of separation and inequality, which I touched on in my introduction, but these apply between us, for example, as service workers and service users, in contexts that are increasingly disempowering for both, as practitioners, field workers and managers in increasingly hierarchical and controlling structures, as service users and family carers, where too often one is put in the position of speaking for the other and the needs of the two are conflated and confused, as public and service users, as if the latter aren't part of the public and should be conceived of as a negative cost on the former, with insidious, high-profile propaganda about the scrounging and dependence of disabled people and other groups of service users and non-citizens, between so-called expert or professional knowledge, research-based knowledge, and the lived experience as service users, with the latter devalued as biased, unscientific, subjective, and unreliable, and user-controlled research, which gives value to that latter, similarly devalued in relation to traditional valuing of conventional randomized controlled trials and associated systematic reviews. And between us, on the basis of issues of diversity in relation to age, gender, ethnicity, sexuality, disability, class, culture and belief, that some grounds face discrimination in society, and frequently schemes for participation mirror rather than overcome these exclusions and prejudices. The long-term trend in public policy, I would argue, has been to reinforce these divisions, inequalities and exclusions. While the post-war UK welfare state increasingly struggled, I believe, to overcome its initial inequalities, the tendency of later and current neoliberal policy and politics has instead been to reinforce them, with its modern rhetoric dividing us into scroungers and strivers, employed and unemployed, hard-working and troubled families, citizens and non-citizens, dependent and independent. So how then do we challenge this if our understanding of participation and involvement is one concerned with challenging regressive power inequalities, supporting empowerment rather than marketisation, commodification and ultimately disempowerment, if we are committed to anti-discrimination rather than discrimination? To make sense of this, let's start with those seeking their own participation and inclusion, and in my view the right place to do this is with the self-organisations, the user-led organisations, particularly established by disabled people and other service users from the 1970s. And here I think, interestingly, some of the most marginalised and disempowered groups, people with sensory and physical impairments, people with learning difficulties, mental health service users and others with long-term health conditions, took the initiative and began to speak and act for themselves, struggling for self-advocacy and self-organisation. As their early organisations spelled out, their goal was inclusion, integration on equal terms, and participation in society, rather than what they were getting, segregation and marginalisation. They had experienced separation and inequality. What they wanted was access to an inclusion in the mainstream and to be treated on equal terms. To achieve this, groups like disabled people emphasised their our separateness. They were often separatist in their approach, but their aim was to put an end to the discrimination they understood disability to mean and to achieve inclusion, unification and reconciliation. The strategy was inclusive, aiming for unity and the equal recognition of difference. Interestingly, the tactics, and we see this so often for oppressed groups, were often separatist on the basis of difference. By highlighting their difference, they sought to be treated with equality and achieve unity and inclusion. Increasingly, while recognising their difference, as for example disabled people or mental health service users, they began to highlight their internal diversity and their overlaps with other groups. They highlighted that even within oppressed and marginalised groups, external hierarchies around gender, ethnicity, sexuality, age impairment and so on could operate, and they increasingly emphasised and evidenced and challenged the ways that such exclusions operate to mean that some people within such groups face particular discrimination, for example, obviously disabled women and black disabled people. They analysed these oppressions through the lens of intersectionality and began to challenge them themselves. They also began to evidence the many groups who tend to be marginalised and excluded even by participatory initiatives. As we, for example, in Shaping Our Lives found out, people who communicate differently, who live in institutions or are homeless or don't have citizenship or are seen as too impaired to be involved or as disruptive or as challenging or not saying what people want to hear. They have revalued, and we've touched on it already, lived experience and the experiential or first-person knowledge that grows out of it, and argued it should be treated as having equality with other forms of expert, professional or research knowledge. They revalidated such first-person knowledge, not only in relation to service users and our experience, but also with regard to health and welfare workers and the practice wisdom that grows from their work experience, encouraging an understanding of their knowledge that is not narrowly restricted to what they, as workers, are taught on formal professional courses, but which also takes account of and draws on their whole experiences through their roles, their identity, the oppression, life and identity issues that many may face. They challenged narrow understanding of what counts for knowledge and traditional inequalities surrounding knowledge claims and so-called epistemic injustice, where some are seen as more credible knowers than others. This is divisive and also damaging in a terrifying way, I feel, to those who face the kind of problems that results in them becoming the subjects of traditional social research. You not only face discrimination and therefore become the subject to study, but you're seen as having less to say of worth about your experience. They have called into question the values of distance, neutrality and objectivity of conventional, traditional, mainstream positivist research, and instead highlighted that these devalue their lived or subjective experience and represent a further layer of discrimination imposed on them, invalidating their understanding of the world. And they've developed instead an emancipatory disability, survivor or user control research which prioritises equal relationships in research as well as personal empowerment and social and political change as its objectives. They question the independence of mainstream conventional research, which is frequently, we know, tied to government priorities and ideology for funding, and is often tied to the values and assumptions of the service system. I want very briefly, if it's okay, if I'm all right for time, to end with two developments which I think characterise current efforts of service users and they're our organisations and allies to develop their own user-led alternatives to dominant participatory discourses and developments. These are Power Us and Mad Studies, both of which I'm lucky to be actively involved in. Both, I think, can be seen as counters to the negative potential of participatory initiatives outlined here, as well as embodied features of current user-led embodying features of current user-led challenges to it. Both seek to be inclusive of people from different standpoints and to address issues of diversity, but with a genuine commitment to emancipatory participation. Both recognise those problems in making possible diversity, and as I've said, try to address them. Both, I think, reject traditional elitist exclusionary approaches to social and welfare policy, and both are now beginning to gain international significance. First is gap mending, an idea pioneered by the European Alliance of Professional Educators and Service Users, Power Us. If you Google that, you'll get to the website, involving service users and family carers in professional education and training, I think has long been seen as one of the most effective ways of improving the nature and culture of social work and associated professions. Power Us, a partnership of social work educators and service users, which is now already involving 12 countries, has sought to develop models of mutual learning in order to change social work practice to be more effective in supporting the empowerment of marginalised groups. Its gap-mending process, which was first initiated at Lund University, Sweden, brings service users and social work students together to learn together on as equal terms as possible. The idea is about bridging divisions between service users and social work students in their learning through new approaches to user involvement. It also represents an alternative approach to the increasing emphasis under neoliberal politics, not just here, I think beginning internationally, on graduate and elite fast-track approaches to social work education, giving value to user knowledge rather than just academic qualifications. People meet as people on gap-mending courses. Service users get formal recognition and accreditation for the skills that they bring, as well as the skills that they gain. Social work students who may have lived experience as service users are valued for it and can share it if they wish. And what we hear from the people who have taken part in these courses, most important perhaps, is the building of trust and understanding between service users and would-be social workers, which we can imagine as likely to have profound effects on future relations and practice between them. Second, I said Mad Studies. The Mad Studies movement, I think it is a movement, is committed to a praxis for radical change, strongly rooted in Canada, also increasingly in the UK and internationally. And for me, this has become perhaps the most important development that's grown out of a search for new understandings of distress, which places value on the lived experience and knowledge of mental health service users. We know that MAD continues to be a contentious word, and not surprising given the abusive, pejorative and devaluing way it's long been used. I think it's been deliberately revisited by MAD Studies to show a determination to reclaim the word by those who identify as service users as experiencing distress and their allies. I feel MAD Studies does offer us hope. It's exciting because of its actual potential to bring about positive change. I also think that the rise of right-wing politics, combined with the increasingly assertive expansion of the psychiatric system, have worked increasingly to stifle alternative ways of understanding and responding to distress. And they've also, I think, formed a powerful, unspoken, informal alliance that focuses on the individual, their responsibilities so seen for their problems, and the assumption of things wrong in our heads. I think Mad Studies, and I'll explain why, has an unprecedented and unparalleled possibility to challenge this status quo, which I see as really damaging, because it offers a real possibility to move on from a narrow, medicalised, individualising model that is closely tied to racialising distress, and which is particularly damaging for Indigenous populations and others facing structural discrimination. It links us up in our different roles and standpoints to give equal priority to user knowledges and experience, taking us beyond over-reliance on professional and medical authority and expertise. I think key elements of it is first, as I suggested, the way it divorces us and itself from a simplistic biomedical model. It allows other understandings and disciplines to come into it instead of solely medical dominance: sociology, anthropology, social work, cultural studies, queer studies, disability studies, history, everything. Second is the value and emphasis it places on first-person knowledge, centering on the first-person knowledge of everyone, not just those psychiatrized. If you want to talk about yourself, then you have a right to. It's okay to include yourself. What we're talking about here is position-situated research. You can't be talking from nowhere as if you had no place in the proceedings, as has been the case in dominant psychiatry. And of course, MAD studies treat survivors' first-hand knowledge with equality. But it also values and has a place, I think, for all our first-hand experiential knowledge, if we are prepared to sign up to some of its more basic tenets. And that's why I think such a wide range of roles and standpoints have and are contributing equally to it. It isn't only as survivors and mental health service users, but also as allies, professionals, researchers, loved ones and so on, that we can be part of this, that we can all work together in alliance. So it includes the experiential knowledge of service users, the practice knowledge, wisdom of workers, and the knowledge from those offering support of family carers as important bases for future mental health policy. Important because we know that all three too often can get left out. I'm going to stop here. I've tried to sum up to offer a critique of how and where we've got to in public participation and user involvement that's connected to the broader ideological, political and democratic issues that it's truly inseparable from. I've also identified conditions associated with the denial of such participation, as well as key examples of how it's being taken forward. Starting with our separation, we seek to create unities. We work for unification, anti-discrimination and reconciliation. We seek to address diversity with equality. We value the inclusion of all ourselves, all of us, all our experience, all our identities. We own and value all of ourselves and all our knowledges. We support research which treats all our knowledge with some equality, first-hand as well as so-called expert. Critically, participation, I would argue, must embrace the personal and the political and their interrelations, personal empowerment and the capacity to make wider change collectively. It must be concerned with these two related aspects of change. I hope the issues I've raised today can be part of, as symbolic of the 40th anniversary of ARVEC, of a growing and inclusive discussion about participation that will offer, to be truthful, more hope for the coming 40 years than, to be honest, the 40 years that people like me have experienced, and build more determinedly on the efforts and commitment of the people from different standpoints and identities who've got us to where we are now. Thank you.